welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today will be no exception. I have in studio with me someone who has become a personal friend. His life story is a story that is interesting, amazing, but I think above all, transformational. My guest is Bishop Themi, and he is known as an apostle to the hungry. I have in front of me a book by Bishop Themi, Apostle to the Hungry. It's his authorized biography. The back of this book tells the story in sum. He's a rock star, an atheist, a Marxist, a world-class theologian, an African missionary, and a Greek Orthodox bishop, and all of that in one life span. I mean, that's an amazing story in and of itself. And his authorized autobiography has actually two forewords. It has a foreword by Father Alexander Karloutsas. And in this foreword, I want to read one paragraph. Father Alex points out that when my guest was made a bishop in the Orthodox Church, he said this: "I will only accept to be ordained if I am to be a bishop for the poor, to the poor, and of the poor." So what you're going to hear in this podcast is a life story, but at the end of this life story, you'll hear a mission, and that mission, that passion, is about the poorest, the least of these, my brethren. As much as you have done this for the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. That's the takeaway to the Hank Unplugged podcast today. With that, I want to introduce my guest formally, and thank you, Bishop Themi, for being on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
My total pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
I actually knew you before I was Orthodox. When I was transitioning into Orthodoxy, you were instrumental in answering some of my questions. You and I have become friends, and I have been intrigued with your life story and wanted to share it with our larger audience.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
So your story reads more like a best-selling novel than a biography, to be real honest with you. You start out as a rock star. I want you to tell that story.
Well,
but even before we get into that story, you were born in Alexandria.
Right, that's where I start off, yeah.
Yeah, tell that story.
Well, I was born in Africa of Greek parents, and that, by the way, later on will help me enormously because during my African mission, there is at the moment, an awakening, an African awakening, and there is some sort of resentment to the former colonial powers that were in charge of Africa and the spheres of influence. And having been born, being a white man, but being born in Africa, I have an advantage. Because I can claim that I am an African in the sense that I was born there. And I would drink the water of the River Nile for the first years of my life. So I have drunk African water. So the issue is that that is a passport to acceptability in today's Africa. In fact, in Kenya, where I started off as a missionary, my apprenticeship into missionary work was Kenya, in Nairobi, the capital city. And the word for the white man in Kenya is Muzungu. And it's not a good term. It's a derogatory term. It's a pejorative term. And I would keep saying, no, mime apana, no. I'm not a Muzungu. He said, but you're a white man. Yeah, I'm a white man, but I was born in Africa. And that sort of now threw a spanner in the wheels. You're born in Africa, okay. All right, so you're a Muafrika Muope. I was no longer a Muzungu, I was a Muafrika Muope, which means a white African. But I've got the African part in there, you see. And I was accepted into honorary member of the Luo tribe and so forth and so on, okay. So Having been born in Africa has been a tremendous asset, advantage in my missionary work. But beyond that, then we immigrated as a Greek family. We immigrated to Australia during the times of the Arab nationalist movements, the rise of, I don't know if you've heard of Nasser, became president, Colonel Nasser became president of Egypt. There was a sort of a very, very fundamentalist kind of Egyptian identity issue. And we were suddenly foreigners in Egypt. My father could see the writing on the wall, and he decided that the future of my children is not in Egypt anymore. The future of my children must be somewhere else. And it was a toss-up between Brazil and Australia. Hmm. My father applied, Eleftherios applied to Brazil through the embassy and Australia. Australia, with its Anglo-Saxon sort of efficiency, responded almost immediately, yes, you're accepted. We're waiting for Brazil because Brazil, we had one of our relatives in Rio de Janeiro, and Brazil was taking a long time to answer. On the basis of the long wait from the Brazilian embassy, my father decided Australia appears to be more professional. So that's why we went to Australia, not Brazil. I would have been speaking Portuguese to you right now.
It's kind of interesting because we were having a conversation before we went on the podcast itself, and you were talking about how the DNA of a child is formed very, very early on in their life. Your DNA was formed very, very early on in your life. How was that DNA formed through...
Yeah. Because of the fact that we knew that we were not completely welcome, right? And as a child, you hear your parents speaking. So the idea of being in one place forever has never been part of my life. So for me to be moving around from place like, you know, the Australia, then back to Africa, then studying in the United States, I can kind of handle that. I can handle it. But eventually, I do want to be more and more, you know, working, you know, all the year in Africa. Because right now, I have to move out of Africa to be asking for money. So I have to go to Australia for 1 or 2 months. Then I have to come to the United States another month. Then I have to go to Greece. That's another month. So a lot of my time that I should be spending in mission work in Sierra Leone or in Kenya, when it was Kenya, is spent begging overseas. But because of this, you know, previous situation being brought up, that you become mobile, you know how to be mobile due to political or social changes going on around you as a child. I mean, I went through 3 periods of revolution in Egypt, that the king was kicked out, then a guy called Naguib took over, and then a guy called Nasser took over. There were constant, these, and then there was the Suez Crisis where the British invaded Egypt. So we were brought up in this social volatile period. And I think that's also helped me to adjust to Africa when things are not, because we have volatility quite a bit over there. Not political volatility, we had the Ebola crisis, we have civil wars. So I think that early childhood experience has helped me.
Yeah, so you just mentioned British invasion, but there was a British invasion of a different sort when the Beatles invaded the world with their music.
Correct.
That is a big part of your story.
Yes.
Tell us that part of the story.
Well, the 1950s and early 60s were dominated by the American music industry, with Frank Sinatra was just fading out when somebody called Elvis Presley was coming in, and Elvis became the rebel image of the new youth movement. You know, people like James Dean, Marlon Brando were all part of that 50s revolution. But it still was not something that led to mass movements around the world. It was just a concept of rebellion, but it did not lead to universities having demonstrations and students imitating, right? What happened in the, and the songs that they were singing was, I love you, you love me, Please don't hurt my heart. I will give you my life because I love you. April showers, da da da. It was all very nice, right? It was all very nice. But suddenly, with the coming of the British invasion, we have like philosophers writing music. We have, not in the beginning, the Beatles in the beginning were not philosophers, but they become people with messages, political messages, social messages. But in the beginning, it was just their look and their sound, which was so different to the Elvis period, to the, you know, Frankie Avalon period, to the surf music Beach Boy period. Well, they were just so different and so revolutionary. And for the first time, it caught the attention that British music, which up to that point was fairly much local and did not have the impact of American popular music, suddenly it becomes the brand. Suddenly, because of the Beatles, it becomes the music standard for the whole world among the young. And they, of course, as you know, they completely take over the American musical industry. And the Beatle imitating groups also become very popular. The people, and of course, Rolling Stones, and then Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix. Even though Jimi Hendrix was American, he had to go to England to become acceptable in America. So once he succeeded in England, then he could be accepted in the United States. But the reverse became true, you see. So as an 18-year-old boy with the Beatle explosion in Australia, I was very much influenced by that. And we formed our own rock group, and we imitated the Beatles in name, in that it seemed that the Beatles were an insect, right? They were copying Buddy Holly and the Crickets. That's where they get it from, right? So Buddy Holly and the Crickets, then we have the Beatles, then you have the Flies.
And you were a fly.
We were the Flies.
Yeah.
Buzzing around. And believe it or not, we achieved popularity because we were the only one of the very few Australian rock groups that looked like the Beatles with the long hair. As you can show the picture from the book from the front page. And we looked at the bottom one, not the top one.
And I finally figured out which one you were.
Yeah, the one on the right hand.
Yeah.
So that look was not available in Australia until we brought it in, and that we became very, very popular, extremely popular. And so that was in the height of our popularity was doing records, having hit records, but also Rolling Stones, being an opening act for the Rolling Stones when they came to Melbourne, you see. So, yes, but that was just a brief period of my life. But it seems to have caught the imagination more than anything else. But that was just a brief period, right, about a year or two, right? After that, I went back to university and continued my studies at university. And that's where I became a Marxist. That's when I turned to Karl Marx. Because I didn't have a religious upbringing. I didn't have one. So becoming a Marxist was, for us students, a worldwide movement. It was a worldwide movement. And it was being fed by the music of the Beatles, by the music of the Rolling Stones, by the music of Bob Dylan. It was being fed. Times are changing. You know, if you heard the Bob Dylan song, times are changing. And that led to the music and the political message. And the catalyst was the Vietnam War. The catalyst was the Vietnam War. Because we believed that to have been an unfair war, a war against a people who were a peasant, a community, fighting what? What were we fighting? It was said, oh, well, you got to stop communism in Vietnam because of the domino theory. It will come all over the world and then it will spread, you see. So we went in to destroy Vietnam. That was... And so many American young men died there. For what? For what did they die? To stop communism? Vietnam is communist. So what did we do? Although capitalist communism, it's a different story now. So basically, Marxism offered the possibility of looking at the world through the eyes of the exploited, the victim class, who are being exploited by the capitalist class and the power elite, which consists of the military, the business, and the political field, the power elite, who dominate the social narrative. And we felt that what was needed was a revolution where the worker takes over, a classical Marxism, and he becomes the ruler of the nation rather than the power elite that exists at the moment. Hence Fidel Castro, hence Che Guevara, hence Ho Chi Minh, hence Mao Zedong, hence all these people who led these Marxists.
Pol Pot.
Pol Pot was a very bad example, actually. Shocking. Shocking, shocking. And a lot of them were shocking, you know, shocking revolutions, you know. But anyway, I dropped out of the Marxist movement when Christ found me. I wasn't looking for Christ, but he found me, and that turned my whole world upside down. In the meantime, I was looking through Hinduism for answers. The Beatles had turned to Eastern religion. Up to then, it was political. But then, you know, we need a revolution and so forth. But then when they turned to Eastern religions, suddenly we thought, perhaps there are other dimensions of reality rather than the economic one. You know, interpreting history from an economic perspective alone, that's, you know, historical materialism, that's fairly, you know, one-dimensional. Perhaps there are other dimensions that we're not looking at, and at least they brought that to our attention, the spiritual dimension, that there is a spiritual dimension. Because Marxism denies that. It denies the supernatural. It denies the spiritual. There is no spiritual. There is nothing beyond the material.
John Lennon really memorialized that in
correct.
Song.
Correct.
Imagine
correct.
There's no heaven.
Correct. 100% correct. But that was later on. He did try transcendental meditation. They did try that. And I did try it. I tried it too as a result of their going east with Mia Farrow, with and all of them together. One of their songs, Dear Prudence, I don't know if you've heard of it at all, it was because of Mia Farrow's sister who would not come out of her room because she wanted to meditate all the time. So John Lennon writes a song, Dear Prudence, won't you come out and play? I don't know if you've ever heard of that song. But so to that degree, we became aware that there might be another dimension besides the physical dimension, right? And so therefore, I started exploring Hinduism, the Hare Krishna movement, not Christianity, because Christianity, according to Marxism, is part of the bourgeois class, part of the capitalist class. But Hinduism was something new. So we looked into that. And eventually it turned out that was one guru who had come to Australia in my city called Melbourne, and he was advancing his meditative system as it was postulated by the Avatar. They claimed that they were following the Avatar, who is God, who visits the earth every 200 or 300 years. The previous avatar, according to most Indians, was a guy called Krishnamurti. I don't know if you're aware of him or not.
I am.
Yeah, good. Excellent. So this new one was a 14-year-old boy, 14. And he was the creator of this divine light mission, the divine light mission. And we were following his guru who had come to Australia. One of my moments of change of life happened in one of these ashrams or one of these assemblies of disciples who seek knowledge, divine knowledge.
Okay? It was the Divine Light Mission, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was the Divine Light Mission. And so what happened was that the guru, I would attend these meditative classes or assemblies, whatever they're called, and the guru would go around different times and he would tap you on the temple here and he would say, receive knowledge, receive knowledge, receive knowledge, receive knowledge, receive knowledge. When he had come to me, the uniform of a 20-year-old at the time, at the height of the Vietnam crisis, at the height of the post-John Kennedy assassination, years after John Kennedy's assassination, and after the assassination of Robert Kennedy, where we finally thought that America has lost the plot, that these great men were being slaughtered by, why, you know? And so, and that America was also in the Vietnam, we just thought, what on earth is happening to this country? What's happening? So there was a lot of sort of agitation, anti-American agitation among the students. But when he came to me, I was wearing my traditional late 60s, early 70s uniform. What's that? T-shirt with an imprint of Che Guevara, a beret with a favorite on top, jeans, naturally, and hopefully with a hole around the knee, right? A tear around the knee. That always was part of the working class symbol, you know, that you work on your knees and therefore you put holes in your jeans. And probably just a purple coat of some sort. And a cross, a big cross, right? The big cross was there because Black Sabbath wore crosses and Led Zeppelin wore crosses. And they were our heroes. So, you know, 20-year-old kid, hey, Led Zeppelin wear crosses. Black Sabbath wear crosses. No problemo. I'll wear a cross too. You know, if they had worn carrots around their neck, I'd wear a carrot too, you know, or a watermelon, whatever it was. It just happened to be a cross, okay? So when the guru came to me to receive divine knowledge, he noticed that I was wearing a cross. And he suggested in somewhat firm ways that I remove the cross. That shocked me because that cross had no meaning for me at the time. No meaning at all. But for him, it had a meaning. It had a meaning for him, which it didn't have for me. So I wondered, what is this cross doing to him? It would be like you having a watch and somebody saying, remove your watch. And you're thinking, what's the big deal with the watch? You know, what's happening with the watch? That draws your attention to the watch in a way that you wouldn't have before. So therefore, I started thinking, this thing is happening, it's doing something. So that was one of my first steps towards Christianity. His absolute negative, up to that point, he was smiling, and divine knowledge, received knowledge, and then, hey, you got to remove it. What is this? How come the change of attitude? So I started thinking about that, about, well, what is this cross all about? Naturally, you turn to the Bible, or you turn to a priest or somebody, a book, St. Augustine's Confessions, I think I would turn to that. And then, as a result of everything, I had, remember the prophet Joel writing in his book, says, old man shall have dreams and young man shall have visions. Chapter 3 of Joel, I'm sure you know it better than I do. And me as a 20-year-old had visions of Christ and the Holy Trinity. Now that's something that was so unusual for me, so alien. It would just left field completely. You know, what am I doing having visions of Christ, who up to this point I thought was a legend, you know, a myth. That according to Nietzsche, it's only the weak who need the religion. It's only the weak who have no will and cannot stand on their own. The Uberman who doesn't need anything outside of himself or herself. And suddenly this turned my whole world upside down. Everything was turned upside down. And so I found the Christ of not the Christ that I was being taught, you know, by the churches or by the evangelists, but the mystical Christ, the mystical Christ, you see.
Well, would you say in that process you had some Damascus Road experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the only thing that would have changed me. I would never have become a Christian if it wasn't for those experiences, because no logic in the world would have turned me away from either Nietzsche or Marx. They make sense. Marx makes sense, you know, from an economic perspective. There is. It's true. The poor are being exploited. That's true. There is a working class. There is an elite class. There is a capitalist class, particularly in this country. It's clear. And so why would I want to change from that? Or again, with Nietzsche, with the idea of being yourself rather than having props to build your character, you rely on yourself. That makes sense as well. But all that had to tumble. It tumbled. Everything tumbled upside down, you know, pushing him away for this mystical presence of Christ, which was so overwhelming and so much more powerful than anything that Nietzsche had said or Marx had said, you know.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. Before you get into this whole notion of your mystical experience or elaboration on that, I want to just for a moment quote what Marx said.
Please.
He said that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It's the heart of a heartless world. It's the soul of soulless conditions. Mm-hmm. It is the opium of the people. And then he said this, the abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness. To call on them to give up their illusions about their condition is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. And then he said that religion was therefore an embryo, the sigh of that oppressed creature. It was the veil of tears. So Marx was very clear that religion was the oppressor. As a Marxist yourself or a neo-Marxist, did you fully understand that aspect of Marxism?
No. On the contrary, we saw it as a liberator. And Nietzsche is very... probably Nietzsche may have borrowed something from Marx, because for him, unless God is dead, then the human cannot exist. So Nietzsche's mission was the idea that the world will never be liberated until the coming of the Uberman, the Superman.
The Ubermensch.
Yeah. Would never occur until religion is put out. All religion is put out. And then will be the liberation of humanity. Now, if you're a 21-year-old, that's appealing, right? But again, I'll repeat, the minute that this mystical experience has occurred, it made all this insignificant, totally insignificant, because this thing that he was fighting, that Nietzsche was fighting against, or Marx was fighting against, it seemed to me that never experienced it. They had never experienced the power of Christ. Marx had never experienced the mystical Christ. What would he have done had he experienced the mystical Christ? Would he still say what he said? What would Nietzsche do if he had experienced the mystical Christ? Well, what would be his reaction? Well, I'm sure it would have been rather different. So I was spared a Nietzschean future or a Marxist future by these mystical experiences.
So you saw divine light?
You know, I don't like talking about it, to be honest with you. I don't want to go too much into this, except to say that what I saw was sufficient for me to believe that Christ is a reality and not a myth, but a reality. And that's all I needed to know.
But you also saw that heaven and hell were real.
Yeah, I did too. I did see the darkness. I saw the darkness as well. Yeah.
So as a result of your conversion to Christ, you recognized that the epicenter of mystical theology is a continual life of repentance.
That came slowly. My first move was to start reading the Word of God, the New Testament, and having read it, I then decided that I had to start again, all over again. You're born again, right? And that meant everything, in every way, born again. Or born from above, as the Orthodox prefer to use that term, from John. sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and come and follow me, and I will show you the kingdom of God. So first thing I did was to sell what I had, give it to the poor, and then follow Christ. But I didn't know how. How am I going to follow Christ? Okay, so I get rid of the car, get rid of, sell this, sell that, take the money, give it to the church, or give it to the poor. So that's one thing that, you know, I did. But then the second thing was, now, what church do you join? Where do you go now? Because Christ speaks about, and upon this rock I will build my church, the ecclesia mu, my church.
Which Paul calls the ground and pillar of truth.
And he calls it the body of Christ.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Corpus Christi. So the idea was now for me to find out, where do I belong church-wise? So I did I went from church to church. My first outing to the Orthodox Church was not successful. I could hardly speak Greek, and the priest that I met could hardly speak English.
And this is in Australia.
In Australia, absolutely. And not now, but, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Not now. Now everything has changed. Now everything has changed for the better, 100% for the better. But at that time, the Greeks in Australia were the immigrants, fresh from the boat, fresh. And the churches that they established were for them and for their needs, right? As the working class, as the oppressed of Australia, as the downtrodden, as the WOGs, as they are called in Australia, or the Dagos, as they were called in Australia, where the only time that Mr. Stephanopoulos could get some dignity was by attending church on Sunday and becoming the president of the church board, or becoming the secretary and being called by his surname and as with dignity. But then on Monday, he'd go back and dig the ditches again, you see, and be slandered at and be yelled at by his Australian counterpart, you know, or boss. So the church, at the time, was for the immigrant. It had no space for a Nietzschean, ex-Nietzschean Marxist. No appetite for that. So I found it difficult in the beginning to communicate with the priests who, he may never have heard of Nietzsche, or they might have heard of Marx, but never heard of Nietzsche.
So actually, because of your background, you started with Orthodoxy in trying to find a church.
Alexandria. I mean, you can't get it. You know, I was born in Alexandria, the Patriarchate of, I was baptized by the Patriarchate of Alexandria. So I had all that background, but it didn't mean anything to me. It didn't mean anything at the time. So eventually I went to other churches. I went to the Presbyterians, and they seemed to be, because I was more Australianized, I could relate to them very well. They would have me witness for the Lord. They would have me to talk about why I've changed my lifestyle, how I did it, and so forth and so on. And I went to other churches as well. But something was pulling me back in the Orthodox Church. One, that I was baptized within the church. Secondly, that I began to read how this is like an ancient church, you know, not a brand new church, but an ancient church. So I decided to give it another try, but this time to another parish, where I went and I spoke to the priest, and he seemed more understanding. And in fact, because I kept talking about the Bible says this, and we got it, he said, oh, okay, I think we'll make you a Sunday school teacher. So suddenly I became a Sunday school teacher on the basis of my reading of scripture, you see. And then it slowly developed where I began to study theology systematically. The archbishop, a new archbishop had come, a younger one, and he decided to send me to a Catholic seminary. I studied theology. Then went on to here in the United States at Holy Cross, doing work at Harvard, studying at Harvard, Princeton, and then my PhD at Brown, where my good friend Michael is from, Providence. And then going back to Australia. But again, going back to Australia to do what? To become an academic, a Christian academic, with all this knowledge that God had given me in the United States with Hebrew, Syriac, Aramaic, Coptic, you know, the scriptures and so forth. You know, beautiful. I mean, it was fantastic. And so I was able to give all I was appointed at the seminary in Australia, at our local seminary in Sydney, where I taught. But then what happened was, at one point I was teaching Coptic at the university, one of the universities. I was teaching the letters of Paul in another university, the University of Sydney. And I was going to give it was a conference, and I was about to give a paper on the interaction between an Archimedi text called the Trimorphic Prytania as it applies to the Johannine Prologue. Now, for most people, that's Chinese. Or, no offense, I love the Chinese, by the way. It was like so esoteric that even academics of the scriptures may not even be aware of what I'm talking about. But the Archimedi texts were the Gnostic texts that were discovered in Egypt in 1945, and which throw a different light on early Christianity, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Philip, etc., etc.
Gospel of Judas.
Well, I'm not sure whether that comes from Archimedi, the Gospel of Judas. But anyway, so one of the texts, the Trimorphic Prytania, speaks about the Father, the Son, and the Father, the Son, and the Mother. I can't remember exactly, but here I am trying to work out what came first, the Gospel of John or the Trimorphic Prytania. If the Gospel of if the Trimorphic Prytania comes first, then hence John is using the Trimorphic Prytania as his model, right? Or vice versa. So I thought that was a really good paper. It was a fantastic paper, right? I should have had a lot of people coming to listen to it. I had three people come to it. And I'd worked on it like for 3 or 4 months on this one paper using Coptic and all that. And then it was like that was a voice speaking to me without voice. And basically saying to me, look, you've given 3 months of your life or 4 months of your life, and the only people who benefit, if anything, even if they had benefited anything, is about three people. Look at what Mother Teresa is doing. Because I was watching documentaries about her. Look at what she's doing. She's helping thousands of people in a real way, not in a sort of a, you know, academic tower way. Look at her. And that was another, now begins my other conversion experience, not from Christianity, but from academia to mission work.
And by the way, part of that was with a Father Kennedy, a Roman Catholic priest.
Oh, very good. Very good. Excellent. Yes. That was also reinforcement, where we had, where I was in Sydney, we had a large Aboriginal community. They had, at that time, they were fairly poor. It was like an area of some problems, alcoholism and so forth. And Father Kennedy, a true priest, Roman Catholic, his church was open to the Aboriginal people. Whereas our churches, the local church was closed, precisely because they didn't want the Aboriginals to come in and steal the candles or whatever they would do. Whereas Father Kennedy, wide open. They could come in if they wanted to take anything, they could take it. If they wanted to smash anything, they could smash it. He was allowing them to do whatever they wanted to do, but he was accepted among the Aboriginal community, and he was a mentor to them, effective mentor. And I admired that. I admired that a lot. And I went up to him at some point, asking him, in what way can I be of some assistance or whatever? And he said to me, you go back to your academic tower. You don't belong here. You're back to your academic. He spoke very frankly. And that hurt me. And I thought, well, why is he saying this to me, you know? But basically he was saying, you go back to your academic tower. You play your game. This is a real man's job here. This is not for you. You just go back and play your games. So all these things happened, and that convinced me that the Lord is showing me something here that I need to take seriously. And so the decision began to brew within me that I need to work with the poor, and no longer to be this elite academic. You're doing obscure papers that only three people could understand. And the other precipitation of that decision to return to Africa was I was having difficulties with my archbishop at the time, because my concern was that the church had become Greek rather than ecumenical, rather than one holy Catholic and apostolic church. It was catering only to a Greek audience. It wasn't catering to the Australian community. It was catering, again, to this ethnic immigrant community, which by now was becoming more professional, albeit, and becoming more sophisticated, yes, but it was still an ethnic church. It wasn't the church that the fathers had spoken about, the one holy Catholic and apostolic church that is for everybody. You could be Greek, you could be Mongolian, it doesn't matter. You are part of the new Israel, and therefore you belong to the body of Christ, you know, if you're baptized and so forth. So I had a problem with that, with him. He was, and God bless him, he's passed away. I still pray for him. I prayed for him last Sunday at church. He wanted a Greek church, a church that, yes, you can have Christ, but at the same time, we must keep our Greek traditions. We must keep our Greek language. Whereas I thought, no, we need to become Australian. We need to be part of the Australian community. We need to bring in the Aussie. We need to bring in the Vietnamese. We need to bring in the Aboriginal. We need to bring in all the community. Why are we exclusive? You know, that caused many problems, extreme tensions between me and him. Until eventually I decided that I can't keep fighting my archbishop. I can't. And it wasn't good for the church to do that, you know, because it was creating, you know, oh, maybe Brother Themi is right. Maybe we should not be so ethnic. Or others were saying, no, the church is you know, I was creating without maybe realizing it. I belong to Apollo. I belong to Paul, blah, blah, blah. So I decided, no. I don't want to be part of anything like that. So I decided to leave the Australian Archdiocese with his blessings, and I did get his blessing. I think he was more than happy to give me his blessings. And I left, and I went, and I had already written to the Patriarch of Alexandria, who is in charge of missions in Africa for the Greek Orthodox Church, and he fully accepted me. His letter was very enthusiastic. Yes. By all means, come to Africa, you know, by all means. And so my previous Archbishop, Stylianos, decided to let me go. Officially, canonically, I left with everything done properly, without any, you know, bad blood, so to speak, except for our difference of opinion on the issue of mission and how what the church should look like in the diaspora, in outside of Greece. And I went to Africa. And that's how it began.
And you first went to Kenya.
Went to Kenya.
And this is sort of the epicenter of HIV/AIDS.
Oh, big time. Kenya was really, really, well, I think, forgive me if I'm wrong, but you can check the facts if you want, but I think one-third of Kenya had AIDS, man. One-third of Kenya had AIDS. And I was put in a church that a great number of the parishioners had HIV/AIDS. Anywhere you went in Kenya, any parish would have had a substantial number of HIV. And that was at the time when we didn't have a real, you know, real cure or a real, not cure, but, you know how today you can manage HIV/AIDS. It can be managed. You can live a normal life and you may not die of AIDS, you know. But then it was a death sentence at that time. It was a death sentence. And so I didn't care because, you know, I thought, well, you're a missionary now. You've come here. If it is to be, to be. If you're going to get AIDS, you're going to get AIDS, okay? That's a badge of honor for you to die, you know, on the mission field, you know, through a disease that has nothing to do with you, you know? So, and the reason why I say to get AIDS is because we in the Orthodox Church, we the priests, once we give out Holy Communion, we give it with one spoon and one cup, and then we have to consume the whole cup. So once I've
whatever remains,
saliva is in there, whatever HIV virus has gone into the spoon or the cup, you have to drink it later on, all of it. So, of course, I did that, and because we believe that it is the body and blood of the Lord, so I was spared the ravages of HIV.
Which is something that you can elaborate on. Maybe right now would be a good time to elaborate on. I want to get to how you got from Kenya to Sierra Leone. But I do want to ask about that same thing. When you were in Sierra Leone, you were in the epicenter of the Ebola crisis.
It's even worse than HIV. I mean, HIV is bad, okay? I'm not underplaying it. I have full sympathy for HIV patients and what they have to go through, and they have my full sympathy. But Ebola, that's a monster. That's a monster. That's like makes HIV look like a choir boy. You know, there's no way you can get out of Ebola once it gets you. At the time that we had Ebola, it was a death sentence. 90% or something like that. It was just incredible. And many caught it. Many thousands died of Ebola. Thousands and thousands died. But within our congregation, within our Orthodox community of Sierra Leone, none of us got it. And I attribute that to prayers.
Not one single person.
Not one single person
that got partook of the common spoon.
That's right. That's right.
Not one person, and there are people dying in the streets.
That's right. Corpses outside the hospitals. They would not be put in the hospital. They would have to be buried in mass graves. But anyway, to get back to...
I mean, this is not something insignificant that you're talking about here. I mean, you're talking about people dying by the thousands and yet not dying when they partake of the real presence of Christ,
We didn't get it. We didn't get it. None of us got it. But even forgetting Ebola, if I may, for a minute, Hank, there are many other diseases in Africa besides Ebola. Ebola now, thankfully, has gone. But we have tuberculosis, which is very contagious. The one thing about Ebola that I think helped us a lot, besides our prayers, is that it can only get it by touch. It's not like COVID. It doesn't go into the air. You can't breathe the Ebola. It doesn't work that way. The only way is by I touch you and you've been sweating or you've some sort of liquid on your body, and I've got a cut, which I do have here on my finger, and that cut touches your liquid, boom, it's all over. That's why I started wearing gloves, and it's a habit I still have of wearing gloves, plastic, you know, those disposable gloves. So I would wear it all day long, so I wouldn't touch anything that was possibly Ebola-based. But I didn't have to wear a mask because it's not an airborne disease, as COVID is. So we managed to avoid it. We managed seriously to avoid it through our prayers, by the great grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, we avoided it.
So you leave Australia, really essentially, I'm not talking geographically, but you essentially leave the Western world.
Correct.
And you go to Africa. You basically sell everything that you have. You're committed to ministering to the poor as someone who is poor yourself.
Correct.
And you now have a passion for the poor. I want you to elaborate for our audience on what that means, because most of us in the Western world do not understand what poverty is.
Well, poverty is a child who has nothing to eat, a four-year-old girl, a five-year-old little boy. His parents cannot help. They don't have any means of helping that child. And that child is forced to go to rubbish dumps in the city to try to find something to eat, or digging through the mud in order maybe of finding metal or something to sell in order to eat. But there's no guarantee he or she is going to find anything. And therefore, it could be 1, 2, 3 days that you will go without food. And the only solution is begging. There's no other solution. There's no social welfare system that you can rely on. The country cannot afford a system that a nation that's been destroyed by civil war for 11 years. They're only now starting slowly, with the grace of God, to recover, slowly recovering. But it's a slow process to recover from such catastrophe. And then we even had the Ebola coming for 2 years, where the nation was locked. We were locked. We couldn't get in or get out, you know. So given all these catastrophes that the nation had to bear, poverty, unfortunately, is the consequence. I mean abject poverty. I don't mean a relative poverty like you have here. I'm talking about abject, absolute poverty, where you can die of hunger.
There are thousands of people, maybe as many as 25,000 people per day
who die of hunger.
Or
hunger or related issues. Like hunger can lead to diseases, and they can die of the disease that has been caused by hunger, you know. But hunger can cause up to 25,000 per day, yes.
And we could feed those people with what we throw away, what's in the garbage.
More than three times, yeah.
So you have this passion to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked. And so you, through the grace of God and through people that you came into contact with, were able to establish a foundation called Paradise for Kids.
Now, Paradise for Kids is not, I'm not in Paradise for Kids. I have basically nothing to do with Paradise for Kids. Paradise for Kids is an organization that has been established in order to be able to send money overseas legally. There is a lot of problems in Australia concerning money sent to religious organizations as a result of the Islamic fundamentalist movement, that many were sending money for jihadic activities but calling it religious. So the government had put in stern sort of conditions as to how money can be sent overseas, bypassing religious organizations. And so Paradise for Kids was established in order as a secular organization, so to speak, which would be sending money to Sierra Leone or Kenya or whatever I was, within the laws of Australia, within the legal. For example, while you can send money for a school, irrespective whether it's a religious school or a non-religious school, you can send money for that. You can send money. So what Paradise for Kids does is raise money overseas and send it to us. But we are a separate organization. We are the Orthodox Church. We are the boots on the ground. Paradise for Kids, like the Presbyterians that you meant and so forth, they raise money. That's their function, to raise money overseas, U.S., Australia, whatever, Paradise, England. And that money is sent. Paradise for Kids is not on the ground in Sierra Leone. There's nobody, it's not on the ground there. It's an overseas organization sending money to us. But there is a Paradise for Kids entity there simply to facilitate the transfer of money.
And that's how you support the church, which is sort of the epicenter of everything that you're doing in Sierra Leone.
Yes. Now, for the Greek donors, that's an apply. There is no law in Greece that prohibits sending of money to religious organizations. And even in the United States, there are different laws. But Paradise for Kids is useful for the Australian situation because we need to know what the laws are in terms of sending money overseas. So we try not to break the law in Australia, because that's where most of our money comes from, with the creation of this organization, yes.
So I want you to explain to me your pattern for mission in Sierra Leone, because it is a pattern that can be duplicated by God's grace. You establish a church, you establish schools, you establish indigenous missions. And there's a really interesting story related to that of a Muslim person who stole a car. You can fill in the details. I kind of have a sketchy understanding of it, but a Muslim man who stole a car, he crashed the car, he's brought back to you by the police. You were supposed to issue charges, but you don't. You say, no, we forgive. You forgive him. He's now a father in the church.
Yes, as a priest.
Elaborate on that. Tell that story
Father
better
Alexander.
Than I can.
But you raised a previous question. The previous question was the methodology of mission. How do we do mission in Africa? I'll get to Father Alexander in a minute, but because I think your question is very important. How we do it in Sierra Leone is schools. We begin with a school. I don't begin with a church. I begin with a school. Now, why is that? One of our fathers of the Orthodox Church, Cosmas the Aetolian, during the time of the Turkish occupation, the Ottoman occupation of Greece, where the Greeks had more or less lost their language, they were being in some ways forced at night to go to school to learn about catechism, the secret schools of children would go late at night under the moonlight to learn the language and also to learn about the church. The Sunday school was basically done very late at night. They were called the kryptaskolia, the hidden schools. And basically the idea that St. Cosmas had is once you develop a school, then you build a church. Because once you develop the school, you can teach the children in the school about geography, biology, etc. But you also teach them about God, right? And from there, you will have your priest that will come in, and then you build the church. But you can do the work of the church within the school. You can still worship. You can still... And because, remember, they were under the Ottomans. There was... So they had a lot of pressure on them. So instead of building churches, they would build schools, which looked to be innocent, right? From the eyes of the Turks, it seemed perfectly acceptable to build schools. But the schools would be used for religious purposes as well, you see. So therefore, and eventually, they would then be able to build their church with the permission of the Ottoman authorities. So I use that as the model for our mission. I build a school. Once I build the school and everything is running in the school, I will build a church next door. Right now, that's how it's working in a place called Crew Bay, where is this horrible slum that I built a school in there.
It used to be a garbage dump, really.
It's still a garbage dump. It's a garbage dump where people live. And I build schools in rubbish dumps, okay? So I've built the school without the church. But now I'm looking for money to build the church because now they're ready. I have a chaplain in there. There's catechism going on. In the classrooms, we do worship. You know, on Sundays, we open up two classes to, you know, like with the folding doors. So we open it up and we have like a church. But it's in the school. So our schools is our weapon. It's our avant-garde. It's the front line of our mission. From the school, we build the church. We build the clinic. We build the welfare centers, the charity centers. We build the, and so forth, the orphanages, you know. From the schools, we begin. And that is our formula in Sierra Leone.
I want to read something that I wrote.
Oh, about Hassan, who became Father Alexander.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you've nailed it. It's exactly what you say. He was forgiven for stealing the car, and he got so impressed by that, because you know, I mean, you know, we respect Islam, but under Islamic law, a thief is treated quite differently to the way Christianity would treat a thief, and so he became so convinced that Christianity had the essence of love in it that he converted. He became Orthodox. And as a result of that, eventually I could see he was very dedicated, extremely dedicated. You know, suddenly he's talking about, you know, Christ and about this, the Bible and so on. I've made him a priest. He's now one of our priests.
I want to read something from your book. I actually wrote a foreword to your book, Themi, Apostle to the Hungry. And I'm reading it for a purpose, but in my foreword, I say, in my trek toward orthodoxy.
By the way, thank you for your foreword. Appreciate it. Thank you.
My privilege. In my trek towards orthodoxy, God brought two noteworthy men into my life. The first was Father Alex Karloutsis, who became a trusted friend and invaluable resource. One day, upon leaving his office, he handed me a little book titled On Wealth and Poverty. And incidentally,
really?
I wrote the foreword to that book now in the new Patristic series. At any rate, that book contained a series of sermons by St. John Chrysostom that imprinted an indelible mark on my future. The second person, he's sitting in the studio across from me right now, was Bishop Themi, whose life personified the very essence of the book that Father Alex had given me. And what is nothing short of a literary pearl, St. John, we're talking about St. John Chrysostom, who was born in 350, takes Christ's famed parable of the rich man and Lazarus. We just celebrated that this Sunday, that parable, and exposits its immeasurable riches. He reminds us that as a little drop is to the boundless sea, so much a thousand years are to that future glory and enjoyment. Through its pages, we become ever more cognizant that this present life is but a drop in the ocean of eternity, that time and what we do now directly impacts the waters of unending time. In profound and poignant fashion, St. John removes the masks and exposes the rich man as poor and poor Lazarus as the most affluent of all. For just as an actor may personify either a wealthy monarch or a destitute beggar, so wealth and poverty mask reality. When the rich man's mask is removed, when he dies, when he departs the theater of the present life, he is revealed as the poorest of all in that other world. So poor indeed that he was not even master of a single drop of water, but had to beg for this and did not even attain it by begging. In that other world, the words of Christ take center stage. I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. And as you did this for one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Thus, what we do now for the least of these, those in need of physical food and water, those who hunger for the bread of life and thirst for the wellsprings of living water, reflects our unmasked inner state, reveals whether we are truly of Christ. This, in essence, is what we may glean from the authorized biography of Bishop Themi, from the life story of a servant who personifies what it means to live in light of eternity, of a man who gave up fame, fortune, academic privilege, prestige, to assuage the hunger and thirst of the least of these, my brethren. And his story, and that's why I'm doing this podcast, his story impels us to do the same. We may not be destined to move to one of the poorest nations on earth, yet through the life story of Bishop Themi, we gain a template for living the duration of our lives with eyes fixed firmly on our eternal destiny. For the time when we, like Lazarus and the rich man, stand before a great white throne and books are opened, a time when all masks are removed, and we are judged according to what we have done as recorded in the books. I thought long and hard about the time as I lay in a hospital bed during a life and death struggle with stage 4 mantle cell lymphoma. During those dark days and sleepless nights, I contemplated the disparate destinies of Lazarus and the rich man, Abraham's bosom and the place of torment. In God's providence, the time of my death, as the time of yours, has been temporarily postponed. Paradoxically, during this postponement, I was afforded the opportunity to write the foreword to the updated edition of St. John Chrysostom's Sermons on Wealth and Poverty. And by the way, we have those available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. But in it, I note that by absorbing the profundity of this patristic classic, we might yet arrive at a true valuation of things. And I say the same thing of Themi, apostle to the hungry. For through the life and legacy of Bishop Themi, we become ever more mindful of the day on which our Lord will say, "Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did it for me." Well, this past Sunday, you preached a homily on that very, very message of Jesus Christ on the rich man and Lazarus.
It came just as a gift to me that that Sunday, you know, that I had such a classic text on my philosophy, so to speak. Yeah.
And a couple of things. I want to get into your philosophy on that in just a moment here. But this book is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Again, available to anyone that stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. I want to say one other thing about the podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. But I want you to elaborate a little bit on this message, your message about considering very seriously what we do with the resources that God entrusts to us, because we will stand before Him. That's an absolute certainty. And we'll give an account of what we did with our lives. And it's not just saying, "I prayed a prayer and Jesus is in my heart." It's what we do with our lives that lays up for us treasure that moth and rust cannot corrupt, that thieves cannot break in and steal. So Jesus said that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Talk about how important it is for us today to invest in the lives of the poor.
Well, we've been brought up on a myth since we were little kids that money is a source of happiness, that money is a source of power, that money is a source of joy, that somehow if we are to pursue money. And that's the realpolitik. That's the reality of life. No matter what anybody says, you know, you hear that from your parents, or you may hear that from your peers or your teachers or whatever. Money is what you should be looking at. You should have money. Whereas the Gospels and the teachings of Christ tell us that to be rich is a problem. It's a salvation problem. That in fact you are disadvantaged in life if you are rich. You are disadvantaged because your chances of salvation are slim. Now that doesn't sound fair, but that's exactly what Christ says. It is very difficult for the rich to enter the kingdom of God. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for the rich man to enter the kingdom of God. So how can a rich man be saved? So here is where the whole issue of poverty comes in. It is the window of salvation for the rich. It's as if the poor exist for the salvation of the rich. Unless you help the poor, the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, what was the crime that led the rich man to enter into Hades? Whereas the poor went into paradise, into the bosom of Abraham. Well, the difference, his main crime was not adultery. His main crime was not money laundering. His main crime was not that he had murdered anybody. For all we know, the rich man may have been a very moral person. He may have been monogamous. He may have respected his wife. He may have been a very honest man. But where he fell on his face was that every time he'd go out of his palace, he would see the poor and do nothing. That was his crime. He saw the poor and did nothing. He saw the plight of the pain of the poor and did nothing. What was the crime of the rich man? Indifference to poverty. So indifference to poverty will lead you to Hades if you are rich. That's your problem as a rich person. You have a problem. And the problem is you're heading to Hades because you're indifferent to the poor. So what Christ offers us, offers the rich, is a way out of that condemnation. And the way out of that condemnation is help the poor. Once you begin to help the poor, then your chances of entering the kingdom of heaven become much better. It's no longer a camel trying to go through the eye of a needle. It's now possible. It's now possible. So basically, let us not admire the rich. Let us not, you know, be jealous of the rich. In fact, feel sorry for the rich. You ought to feel sorry for them. You ought to pity them because their chances of entering heaven are almost zero. You see? So my idea is I feel sorry for the rich and I want to help them to enter the kingdom of heaven.
So contextualize this for me. A rich man can help a poor man, but a poor man cannot help another poor man.
No, on the contrary. I will tell you how it happens. The rich man can help the poor, and the poor man can help the rich big time because he's helping him to enter the kingdom of God, right? But the poor to the poor, it can also work that way, that the poor can be very generous to each other. I can give you many examples of that. You know, like, well, let me give it to you in an African saying. If you help a man, you are helping his family. If you help a woman, you're helping the village. In other words, there will be an outward going of help by the fact that you've helped one person. So sharing among the poor is not unusual in an African context.
By the way, why is it more significant? You make that transition from helping a man and helping a woman. What is the significance of a woman?
The significance is that the African woman, let me put it, how can I put it? The African woman is the backbone of Africa. The African woman is what preserves the family in Africa. The African woman is she who keeps the family and feeds the family, by and large. Now, that's a generalization, okay? And I keep saying, let those who give out the Nobel Peace Prize give it 1 year to the African woman. She, above all, brings peace and brings stability. She brings stability to Africa.
I want to stick for a moment on what we're talking about with the rich. The founder of Paradise for Kids is a man who God has blessed mightily from a financial standpoint. And
well, he claims that he was basically going through a hard time financially before the creation of Paradise for Kids. But since the creation of Paradise for Kids, he claims that he has been blessed with an abundance of wealth.
Well, and that's another really important point.
But because he's helping.
But that's another very important point, because giving is not a zero-sum game. Meaning you don't have just a pie this big and you take a slice out of it and you give and then you only have this much remaining.
That's what he says. I'm only repeating what he said. But the point remains that the more you give, the more you will receive. That's just a simple truth of the matter. I even get the kids in Sierra Leone to understand that. The poor kids, the destitute kids. What I do, I say to them, when they're in church, I say, okay, John, how many pencils do you have? I only have one, sir, or father. I want you to give it to the person next to you. But I won't have a pen. I said, don't worry. Give it to them and see how many pens you'll have next week and come and tell me. So I do experiments with them to learn how to give and not to be afraid, because God will reward them for giving. In giving, you will receive. And I get back messages about that. Oh, yeah, it's true. So, but in the beginning, it's very difficult, because if you only have one pen, you don't want to give it away, particularly if that's all your pen you have. But once you learn to give that pen away, and I try to do it to the little kids, then they learn that it's going to come back to you. Three or four pens will come back to you.
So you gave up virtually everything, but have you really given up anything? Meaning your life is a rich, full, and productive and very edifying life. You're changing the lives of many people. So you have been blessed. You've been given a reward, not only in the life to come, but a reward now.
I seek first the kingdom of heaven. I'm not trying to act holy or anything like that, because I'm not. I am a filthy rag, but I can tell you right now, I am seeking the kingdom of heaven first. That's number one, right? As a result of that, God gives me the things that I need. I don't have to worry about food. My salary is 11,000 euros a year. That's about $12,000 a year. That's my salary. And even then, I can't get it out of Greece. I have to stay in Greece. So basically, I live with the grace of God, okay? I own nothing because everything I own is in other people's names. It's not in my name. I have a small unit in Australia, but that's under my sister's name. So basically, I don't own anything. But I see that as a blessing and power rather than weakness, because I see what God does for me. Blessed be his name. But I'll never go hungry. I'll always have a bed. I'll always have a full life, an adventurous life as well, an exciting life. Always unexpected things happen, meeting so many people, even becoming a bishop. I mean, that is unbelievable, all these things happening. And yet they do happen. And that's only because you surrender to God completely. You surrender to him, but in confidence, not in fear. In confidence that whatever he says is true. And therefore, these other things you are seeking, like this bottle of water, which I never bought, but I'm drinking from it, shall be given unto you. Which reminds me of a joke. What kind of food, they asked Socrates, do you enjoy eating the most? He said, the one that other people buy for me.
Yesterday, you had a little girl. I introduced you in a meeting yesterday, and there was a little girl there you brought up, and you asked her some poignant questions. You asked her, do you have
a
bed and shoes and so forth? Tell that story.
Well, I do that quite a bit. I do that quite a bit in order to reinforce to the children how fortunate they are to live in a country like this one, or Australia, or Europe, how fortunate they are. And how they should not take it for granted. So what I do is I get them to realize that the number of shoes they have is far in excess of what is basically necessary in Africa. How the fact that a bed is a big deal. How would a child know that a bed is a big deal, right? Or a pillow. A pillow is a big deal. A mattress is a huge deal. When we bring mattresses from overseas in containers, I have to have security guard. As we take out the mattresses from the container, I have to make sure there's not a riot take place. A riot. A mattress is unbelievable. It's an unbelievable luxury. So let them understand as children, and there's something else that I'm concerned about, how much you spoil your children, you Americans, you Australians, you Europeans, how much you spoil Johnny, how much you spoil Suzanne. Whatever Suzanne wants, she gets. No. Every now and then say no. Little Johnny runs the show. Tell Johnny no. Tell him no. Because one day he's going to grow up and he's going to get a lot of no's outside and he won't know how to deal with it. So we're tending to spoil a whole generation of young children and making them also obese.
How can people support your mission?
How can they? I have the man here. His name is Michael. Michael is a man from Rhode Island, though he's living in Massachusetts now. And I've known him from a child, and is a devout Christian, Orthodox. He's gonna tell you how.
The gentleman who should be speaking, unfortunately, he's in Australia at the moment. I think as I walked in, you were talking about him, Hank. Louis Tumbas, and just like His Grace, Bishop Themi, Louis Tumbas, through somewhat of a miracle, had a big conversion in his life, And he came to Christ, and he was somewhat of a ruthless businessman. Forgive me if you hear this, Louis. But he had a change in his life. He did a total 180, and he became somewhat of a righteous businessman. He dedicated his life to helping the poor, specifically through Bishop Themi. And back in about 2007, he created a charity and organization in Australia known as Paradise for Kids. And he made it his life's work to help the poor through Bishop Themi. And Paradise for Kids has become a global entity now. It's established all over the world. It's a 501c3 here in the United States. And it is comprised completely of volunteers all around the world that help. And every dollar that Paradise for Kids raises goes to sponsor the Orthodox mission in Sierra Leone, which is underneath the Patriarchate of Alexandria. And a lot of people in Australia didn't buy that Louis had this change of heart and this conversion. And on a personal note, he says the reason why he did it is that when Judgment Day comes and he's standing before the throne of Christ, he can point and say, "I'm with that guy." And hopefully that will be his
and
ticket.
Hopefully
in.
I will say, "Yeah, I know him."
So,
but what if I'm in a bad mood? What will happen then?
That'll be difficult for me.
That's a joke for you.
So let's sort of end this podcast by, I want to quote a little passage from the book of Revelation. People that know me know that I love the book of Revelation. It's only 404 verses, and the vast majority of them come directly from the Old Testament. So if
and
you know the Old
only
Testament.
We don't read in the lectionary in the church.
Yeah. But it's,
because it became canonical way after the lectionary was compiled.
But it is the revelation of Jesus Christ which God gave him to show his servants what must soon take place. And in Revelation chapter 21, the Apostle John sees a new heaven and a new earth, because the first heaven and earth have passed away, and there's no longer any sea. He sees the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, prepared as a bride, beautifully adorned for a husband, and he hears a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and he'll be his God. He'll wipe every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, mourning, crying, or pain, for the older of things will have passed away. Behold, all things will have become new." These words are trustworthy and true. And what I think is so important about that passage is right now, Christ has not come in the second advent. And there's death, mourning, crying, or pain. And your message is, we are the instruments of Christ to alleviate that hunger and that thirst, and that we need to take that seriously. It's not something we can postpone. It's not something for another day, but it's something we need to be involved in right now. And actually, by meeting the physical needs of people, we so often have an opportunity to meet their spiritual needs as well. That story you told about the Muslim who you forgave, who has now become a father, that's a poignant story of how someone was met at the point of their need, and as a result of that, was utterly transformed from a spiritual perspective as well. Close us, Bishop Themi.
Well, you've raised a couple of issues, all right? One of them is the need to take care of people who are suffering. That's a non-negotiable issue. Why? Because of all world religions and philosophies, the only one in which the founding figure identifies with the suffering, identifies in total solidarity. I was hungry. He didn't say there are hungry people in the world. He didn't say there are thirsty people. There are sick people. I was sick. I was hungry. The ego, the ego, the I is there. And so he becomes the poor man. He becomes the beggar. There is a very interesting story told in the hagiography, the life of saints, whereby Saint Martin, Martinos in Greek, is walking along. He's a poor man, and he has an old jacket, an old coat, and he sees this beggar. And the beggar summons him and says, "Martin, I'm very cold. Martin, I'm very cold and hungry." And Martin says, "I don't have any money, but I can give you my coat." So he takes off his coat, even though it was cold, and gives this beggar, this pathetic beggar, he gives him his coat, his old, you know, torn coat. And the author of this tradition writes, "At that very moment in heaven, when Christ was in his seat of glory and the angels around him were chanting and praising him, not daring to look upon his glory, one angel who dared to look upon him and saw the Master sitting on the throne and asked timidly, 'Master, why are you wearing this old coat?' And the answer came, 'Because my friend Martin gave it to me.'" So this is the, "I was hungry, I was sick, I was..." This is unique to us Christians. So there's nothing more compelling and nothing more rewarding than serving the crucified Christ, the barefoot Christ, the hungry. That's how I survive there. Because I don't think I'm feeding Christ. So when I look at that kid who is crying, when I look at that woman who... without a husband, whose husband has left her, and she's got four kids, and she's desperate, I think, "Oh, well, this is Christ, and he's testing me," you know? And that's how I'm able to do what I do. But if I just look at it from a secular point of view, or I'm doing charity, you know, just another number of charity, but no, this is Christ. When I look at that guy without legs, you know, he's crawling on the ground to come to me. They crawl on the ground. And I think, what would I do in his... what would I do if I was like him? You know, and I admire his courage. And he would look up without legs and say, I need your help. I need your help. You know, I need your help. I look at the eyes. I say, this is Christ. This is Christ. This is the black Christ, you know. So that is how I keep going with this. That's how I keep going.
Well, that's an appropriate place to end, because Bishop Themi is, as the title of this book says, Themi, Apostle to the Hungry. It is available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. All you have to do is write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271, or just go to the web at equip.org. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast.
May I thank you also, Hank, for inviting me here, and to all your listeners to continue to support you. You're a brave man. You've made some very brave decisions. You've also gone through so much in terms of your health, and you survived. And obviously God is keeping you in a good state at the moment for the reasons of his glory. So thank you. In the words of Creole in Sierra Leone, thank you, beaucoup, beaucoup.
Well, thank you. You're a dear friend, and I'm so privileged to know you. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We'll see you next time with more of the podcast. So long for now.